Nobody has more respect for women than I do. Nobody.
Hillary Clinton wants to abolish it, believe me. She wants to abolish our Second Amendment.
I think they didn't deny it. I don't think anybody denied it.
Other presidents did not call. They'd write letters, and some presidents didn't do anything.
Many people have come out and said, I'm right.
You really do have to ask yourself, where does it stop?
Hello and welcome to Fallacious Trump, the podcast where we use the insane ramblings of America's worrying mole to explain logical fallacies. I'm your host, Jim.
And I'm your other host, Mark. A logical fallacy is an error in reasoning that results in bad or invalid arguments. And the logical fallacy we're looking at this week is the toupee fallacy.
Yeah, the toupee fallacy.
What's named?
It's really yeah. Well named, actually. It's a very specific offshoot of the argument from ignorance, really. Because it's right. About making a decision based on the fact that you're not seeing any disconfirming evidence. Any evidence on the other side. And in a way, there's a little bit of survivorship bias in there as well, because there's a specific reason that the actual evidence that that exists on the other side isn't part of the sample that you're taking, essentially.
Right. Yeah.
And so the canonical example, and the reason it's called a toupee fallacy, is when people say something like, all toupees are shit, I've never seen a good one. I've never seen a convincing toupee.
Yeah. Obviously not watched Morecambe and Wise at all, because, you can't see the joint.
Yeah, and the point is that if you did see a convincing toupee, you wouldn't know it was a toupee. You'd think it was someone's hair. Therefore, you don't factor that one in to your sample set of all toupees. So all the ones that you notice are shit, because they don't look like real hair.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
But you're ignoring the fact that you are not noticing the good ones.
Yes, and even if you were shown one, in order to be convinced of it, you'd have to take it off, at which point you could say, well, I can tell that's a toupee.
Yeah.
So you could also move the goalposts slightly, can't you, to kind of include the set.
Yeah, once you get someone entering evidence into your sample set and kind of showing you stuff, then this starts to break down. If people continue to argue this, then they're probably using other fallacies to do that. But the idea that you think that you know something because the information or the evidence on the other side is kind of by definition not something you would notice if that's what you're looking at.
Right.
Our first example from Trump comes from a tweet that he sent back when he had a Twitter account back in 2012. He said, I always enjoy watching young entrepreneurs enter the business world. I can tell who reads my books and who doesn't. So my assumption of that is, and maybe I'm being unfair, but I don't think I probably am, that he thinks that he thinks that people who read his books will be successful. So he looks at successful entrepreneurs and assumes that they've probably read his books.
Yeah.
But even, I mean, he may be right in some cases about that, and he probably doesn't question them or didn't during this period. But more importantly, there will be a number of people who have read his books and then have not become successful entrepreneurs to the point where he would notice them entering the business world.
Yeah, there you go. That's where the survivorship bit comes in, yes.
So he's not going to notice any of the failing entrepreneurs who have read his books, or the people who read his books but weren't motivated enough to try and get into the business world. He won't see any of those. So he's looking only at a small subset and deciding, that
then,
proves
then
that my books
that
are successful.
Those who've entered the business world are the ones that have read his books. So
there's several layers in that one.
But there's also the kind of, you know, all we've got is the evidence of his eyes. You want to say, well, how can you tell? Well, I can tell because they're the successful ones. No, but how can you tell they've read your book? Well, because they're successful. The successful ones. I could just tell. Well, how is it that you tell? Well, because they're successful.
And if that is his reasoning, that aspect of it, we're assuming, then there's a certain amount of circular reasoning there as well, isn't it? Because I can tell they've read my books because they're successful. And they're successful because they've read my books.
So it must be possible to find somebody who is in the business. Well, he wouldn't consider them successful because they haven't read his book. Well, there you go. That its own
you could absolutely
is the measure
you
of success.
You could produce entrepreneurs who have been successful and haven't read his books, and you could produce failures who have read his books. I mean, yeah. I know he hasn't ever read any of his books. So
no, no, he
didn't. It's a bad example.
So, you know, that's. So at that point, I'm hearing the rapid rush of a V8-powered set of goalposts moving around because he'd just go, oh, yeah, but, you know, that's because they haven't read my book. Or, well, they're successful. Said, well, yeah, but are they really successful? Yeah, they're not really a true Scotsman. It's that kind of, they're all lumped in there, aren't they? In that kind of self-professed evidence base. I think it's not on his part a willful ignorance of the fact that he's choosing an already select set to base his evidence on.
Yeah, I think that's... one of the things about this fallacy is it's not one that people use knowingly to back up a bad argument. It's something where their reasoning is fooling themselves, essentially, or their lack of reasoning is causing them to have an opinion that isn't backed up by evidence, essentially.
Yeah. So it's kind of, it's almost forgivably naive.
To some extent, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's certainly naive. Yeah.
So our second Trump example comes from a time back in 2017 when he was talking about his big wall, and he claimed that the people of San Diego really wanted his wall.
Right.
But the governor of California at the time, Jerry Brown, he was reluctant, but Trump was building the wall anyway. But then at one point he decided, maybe I just shouldn't build the wall there because then the people of San Diego, who really want the wall, will put pressure on the governor of California to ask for the wall that I'm already building, or something like that.
Right. Okay.
So I said, let's stop building the wall. I said, how much would it cost? Because I know too much about contractors. I think half the room is contractors. Look at these people. I can tell a contractor. I can smell a contractor, believe it or not. Got a lot of contractors in this room. So I said, find out how much it would cost to stop. And one of the generals said, sir, it wouldn't cost anything to stop. I said, really? Find out. Well, he came and he said, it's $7 million to stop. I said, all right, keep building it, okay? I'm not going to stop it for that, right? We got to get it done.
No general called him.
In the middle of that imaginary conversation that he had with a general.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can tell a contractor, I can smell a contractor. And he was kind of looking around the room, the arena, and saying, you know, there's a lot of contractors in here, I can tell. And again, they're, you know, if they are wearing lumberjack shirts and a tool belt and, you know, and sucking through their teeth looking at something and saying how much, you know, what cowboy put this in, then maybe he can.
Yeah, yeah. It's not just your parts, it's your labour and your tax.
But there are obviously going to be people who he might think are contractors who aren't, and there are also very likely going to be people who are contractors who don't look stereotypically like a contractor.
Like contractors.
But obviously those people, he wouldn't say, oh, well, yeah, he's a contractor, I can always tell. He just would ignore that person.
Yes, exactly.
And therefore not be able to tell, but not know he hadn't been able to tell that person wasn't a contractor.
Yes, yes, there you go. Yes, it's ignorance of your own ignorance, isn't it? It's an unknown. it's that kind of, that naive ignorance and uncritically thought about, because he's not going, oh, wait a minute, why can I only see contractors here? You know, why is it? He goes to a meeting of the Contractors Union of San Diego, and they've all dressed up to meet the president. So none of them are wearing lumberjack shirts and tool belts. So they come in the room, and he'll just go, well, where are all the contractors? Yeah, I'm obviously in the wrong room. And he won't kind of think, oh, no, that's because they're dressed up to see the president. Of course they're contractors. It's just that my cognitive bias leads me to believe that they're not, and I'm in the wrong place.
Now, at this point, when he had this imaginary conversation about the fact that for some reason he sent a general to find out how much it would cost to stop
even
building
the wall. Even though he could tell a contractor, he obviously can't tell what contractors do. He can't tell that a general doesn't know about contracting.
And I'm pretty sure it wasn't $7 million to stop building the wall, largely because he hadn't started building the wall at that point, certainly in the San Diego area. The question of whether the people of San Diego wanted the wall is another point. But basically most of what he said there was bullshit, and the bits that were direct quotes were made up.
Plus the bit, the kind of the whole thing that San Diego wants the wall, well, he's only going to have heard that from the people that wanted the wall.
Yeah, that's true.
In San Diego. So he might have met some people in San Diego who wanted the wall. Therefore, because that chimes with his position, he would say, right, so, well, San Diego wants the wall. All the people I've spoken to want the wall. Well, but you've only spoken to the people who want the wall.
But also, even if everything he said there was true, which it wasn't, even if that happened exactly as he claims it happened, that is an anecdote about him saying, shall I be a dick to someone? Because I think this wall is what our country needs and the people of San Diego want it, but I could just be a dick and not build the wall so that one particular governor who doesn't like me has a bad day.
Yeah, gets it in the neck. Whilst along the way, belittling a general.
Well, by implication, allowing drugs and immigrants to flow freely into San Diego.
Yeah. So. Yes, exactly. Yes. Mm. Mm. Yeah. So in finding this, I was looking up just that phrase, I can just tell, that kind of stuff, and I typed it in, and up popped Biden. Mm-hmm. So is this our first Biden example?
I think it probably is, yeah.
Probably. But yeah. And this one is at a town hall Q&A type thing, and somebody stands up to ask him a question.
That is Danielle Lippi. She's a student here at the university, and she's a Republican. She's got a question for you. Go ahead, Danielle.
Okay. But your dog's a Democrat, I can tell. I'm teasing. I'm a big dog person. I'm sorry.
Well, we know that he's got Democrat dogs that he had to get rid of, one of whom died, and the other one bit
I mean,
people.
To be fair to Biden, all dogs are Democrats because they're not assholes.
Ah, there you go.
Dogs.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Yeah. So his evidence for he can just tell you it's a good gag, but you want to kind of. So I've changed my question. My question is, how can you tell a dog's a Democrat? And then he could launch into, well, that's easy, because no dogs are assholes.
Yeah, cats are Republicans, because dogs are Democrat.
Yeah, and I'm not even questioning that. I can just tell. Yeah, I've seen enough TikTok videos to know that that's exactly right. Uh-huh. Yeah. Yes, there's something about the kind of individual haughtiness of cats. Brilliant. Whereas dogs are kind of communal beasts that look out for each other and the people that look after them. Yeah.
And now is the time, I think, for Mark's British Politics Corner.
Well, as usual in British politics, they're kind of... I think British politicians are a little bit more reserved in just making any audacious statement on the basis that, well, apart from, and I couldn't go back there again, we did it twice, apart from everyone's had enough of experts. Well, actually,
twice. I know, yeah. We've gone back to that many times.
I know. But it's the same, it is the same deal. But nobody has said... I can just tell. No one says that as their evidence base for what they're about to say. But you know full well that they're doing it from a select evidence base. You know, they don't say I can just tell unless they're talking about the price of a bottle of champagne or that there's no difference between a party and a work event. And no one says I know even unless they're saying I know how the nurses feel, or I know how difficult it's been following the rules under COVID. And they don't say that because it sounds hollow, fake and patron. No, they do exactly say that. But it's very rare to find anyone so wedded, and I think this is it, you can't find anyone so wedded to a particular standpoint sufficient to cite themselves as holding the evidence. So the kind of the silent evidence that they're not providing, they're just going, well, this is it, and they're not doing the kind of critical thinking and saying, okay, my evidence base is this, and I know that it's very selected and blah, blah, blah. And I think the reason they do that is because they may have to change their reported viewpoint and get deafened in the process of the sound of squealing tires as they pull another U-turn at high speed. And they might be doing that sometime in the very near future, depending on how things go down on social media. What they do is invoke sure and certain knowledge of the British people's opinion. That's what stands in. They make a selected, a highly selected version of the British people in order to justify and license and give them a mandate to enact appalling legislation on the basis of performing their public duty. And of course, what they make sure of, and this is where the fallacy comes in, is they only listen to the British public whose opinions align with their particular party policies, which leads us inevitably back to Priti Patel and her July 2021 justification for the anti-refugee proposals currently being taken forward in the Nationality and Borders Bill.
Mr. Deputy Speaker, the British people have had enough of open borders and uncontrolled immigration. Yeah. Enough of economic migrants pretending to be genuine refugees. Enough of people trying to gain entry illegally ahead of those who play by the rules. The British people have had enough of being told that none of these issues matter. They've had enough of being told that it's racist even to think about addressing public concerns and to fix this failed system. The British people, perhaps the Honourable Gentleman would like to intervene or listen. The British people have repeatedly voted to take back control of our borders, something that the party opposite have repeatedly voted against and complained against. The British people finally have a government that is listening to them, because our priorities are the people's priorities.
Well, they're not. You know, it's that kind of, it's that weasel stuff. So she cites no evidence beyond repeating the British people. So when you say the British people, that conjures up, well, that's everybody then. That's, you know, I could just go ahead and do this because the people's policies are our policies. And I hate that little bit where she tells the guy off over there. He's like, oh, God, I hate her so much. And nobody complains against anything. People complain about stuff. But that's not.
I think there is actually in there a little bit of implication that she can tell the difference between a genuine refugee and a fake refugee.
Yeah.
In a way, which is kind of, there's that, you know, I've never seen a real refugee. All the refugees I see are just economic migrants.
Yes, exactly. Yes, there's people there is people escaping or they're being trafficked or all of that stuff. So that, yes, quite. So, and of course, what happened as a direct result of that position, only 500 visas have been issued by the UK to refugees fleeing from Ukraine by the 8th of March 2022. In the same week, the UK's neighbours in Ireland and France, i.e. parts of the EU, had waived visa requirements and taken in 2,000 and 34,000 refugees, respectively. Of course, Patel's British people is completely out of sync with public opinion, as Sky News and Jason Mohammed's phone in on BBC Wales show, in providing the actual evidence of the British people disagreeing with what Patel says the British people want.
The government should be doing more, but let's get back now to being human beings.
Yeah, I think it's shameful, really. It is a shame that the general public now have to get off their bums and do what we can, but that's what we're really good at.
What can we do quickly right now? We're nearly into week three of the war.
We should be letting them in, and if people are willing to house them, good on them.
There is room in North Wales for people to come. We, and that's my wife and myself, we are more than happy to have people from Ukraine.
It's a moral obligation, I think, for us all here to be able to do something.
Why would we refuse these people that are in desperate need?
They are the British people. You could tell because some of them from Wales. They're the British people. And So Patel can tell what the British people think because she's polled specific people, or the people that voted Leave, basically. That's where they took their mandate from. So when you, and I think this is how you can counter that thing, is just go, well, wait a minute. You can tell what the British people think. I can tell what the British people think. And this is what the British people think. You go, well, okay, here are some British people not thinking that. I think your evidence is a little bit shaky.
Yeah.
So,
counter is to provide evidence that doesn't corroborate their opinion and see where they go from there.
Yeah. Quite. And you can point out to them that they're being very selective in their viewpoint. And this, I think, is the difference between, Trump's kind of goofy-esque innocent ignorance, he doesn't know that he doesn't know. Whereas Patel and the whole of the British government, this is where it becomes, when it's a willful ignorance, when it's a willful being blind to the other the other evidence sources outside of your bit. Well, I can tell what the British people think. But we know you're doing that as a deliberate act, and so consequently, when the British people let you down and say things contrary to what you can tell, what happened here in response to this groundswell from the same British people on March 14th, a different department of the UK government, not the Home Office, launched the Homes for Ukraine's idea, and thousands of people signed up.
The scheme will allow Ukrainians with no family ties to the UK to be sponsored by individuals or organisations who can offer them a home.
45,000 people in the UK have signed up to offer their homes to Ukrainian refugees fleeing the war.
Yeah, now the government's Homes for Ukraine website was so popular that it crashed shortly after it went live yesterday as people rushed to register.
But I'd like to see every MP who's got those second homes in Wales volunteering. They'll all mouth, but let's just see them put their money where their mouth is.
One of those planning to sign up is former Health Secretary Matt Hancock.
Of course he is.
Yes, of course he is. So this to me is just more evidence of Boris seeing which way the crowd is going and then running to the front and shouting, follow me. And yeah, one of the people, of course, signing up is desperate comeback kid Matt Hancock. And, rather cruelly, probably accurately, let's face it, he's got 5 bedrooms. No one's using them since his wife left. So, he's on there, and that's the point at which I turned off because I'm just not going to give him any more time. And there he is, sitting in the chair with his little Ukraine ribbon on, and you think, oh, just leave it. So, yeah. So the other side of this kind of deliberate, willful ignorance about what's going on outside of your window of experience, of evidence. Of course, when the silent evidence, so all the stuff that you're leaving out, starts speaking up for itself, there's the risk of that evidence being deliberately silenced. And new polling revealed by the Independent newspaper on Sunday indicated that the majority of British people are back accepting more asylum seekers, and that less than a third want a system that deters refugees. And this is troubling for the Home Office, which commissioned the Britain Thinks consultancy to carry out research on this strategy last year. The researchers received more than 8,500 responses from an online questionnaire, meetings, interviews and focus groups. I took part in that. The Home Office Department has refused to publish the full results of a public consultation on its new plan for immigration whilst pushing to enforce it using the upcoming Nationality and Borders Bill. Sile Reynolds, the head of asylum advocacy at Freedom from Torture, told The Independent that the government had misrepresented public compassion for refugees time and again and is refusing to release the findings of that public consultation on the new plan for immigration because then it would have to admit that the public does not want the heartless anti-refugee proposals being taken forward in the bill.
Yeah, that is the problem with asking people what they think, is that they tend to tell you what they think.
That's the problem, yeah. If you go ask their opinion, people will have one. That's the problem with people. Yeah, And you can't guarantee that they will continue to be the British people voicing the evidence upon which you're acting.
Yeah, I mean, these people, they just haven't seen enough Yes Minister, have they? That's no. The thing. They need to be asking the question in the right way, and then they'll get the answer they want.
Yes, exactly.
He's a charlatan who surrounds himself with ne'er-do-wells. You can see he defied for wishes we'd all go to hell. And the blonde horror's still pretending that he's Churchill. Fallacies in the wild get the bones, though you never can tell. He furnished an apartment with donations from a millionaire. And denied he attended all the parties that he went to there. And when he found the boats coming in worked out well. Fallacies in the wild get the bones, though you never can tell.
So there's Chuck Berry there with his fallacy counter-argument. You never can tell.
In the Fallacy in the Wild, we like to talk about the Fallacy of the Week from a non-political perspective, and our first example comes from Wellington Paranormal. Have you seen Wellington Paranormal?
No, I'm desperate to ask, have you seen this?
It's fucking brilliant. It is a mockumentary, New Zealand mockumentary,
right,
from the people who did What We Do in the Shadows. The main two characters in the police mockumentary were in the What We Do in the Shadows film.
Oh, okay, yep.
And so this is a kind of spin-off in a way.
Right.
But this is the very small paranormal department of the Wellington Police Department.
I mean, we interviewed the leading suspect and came back with nothing suspicious.
You sure he wasn't a vampire?
He just wasn't remotely suspicious.
He was too normal, if you know.
But did he have fangs?
It's hard to remember. He might have had little tiny ones, perhaps.
Vampire. Did he glamour you?
Like give us a glamorous makeover?
No, not on my watch.
Glamouring is a hypnotic form of sorcery, or spell. It's a power that's innate in vampires. They can use it to charm people, or even erase your memory.
Now, I'd remember something like that.
And even if he perhaps didn't, I certainly would remember that.
I want you to get back to that hospital and interview that guy from the blood bank again. I think you may have been glamoured.
Still think we'd remember it.
It could even erase your memory. I'm sure.
I definitely remember something like that.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's a fairly clear example. I think it's the obviously Minogue, which is the name of that cop, is convinced that he would remember, and the evidence that he wouldn't remember is the bit he's not noticing because he can't remember it.
Yeah.
Because he can't remember the thing that was done to him that would make him not be able to remember. So he's excluding that part exactly. from his sample.
Yeah. Yeah.
Of things he could remember. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a very, very good show. I recommend it. Our second example comes from When Harry Met Sally.
You are a human affront to all women, and I am a woman.
Hey, I don't feel great about this, but I don't hear anyone complaining.
Of course not. You're out the door too fast.
I think they have an okay time.
How do you know?
I mean, how do I know I know?
Because they...
Yes, because they...
How do you know that they're really?
What are you saying? That they fake orgasm?
It's possible.
Get out of here.
Why? Most women at one time or another have faked it.
Well, they haven't faked it with me.
How do you know?
Because I know.
Oh. Right. That's right. I forgot. You're a man.
What is that supposed to mean?
Nothing. It's just that all men are sure it never happened to them, and most women at one time or another have done it, so you do the math.
You don't think that I can tell a difference?
No.
Get out of here.
So, Harry is convinced that he can tell the difference between a real orgasm and a fake orgasm, and Sally is not so sure and is about to convince him otherwise. And Harry assumes... that he's only seen real orgasms because he can't conceptualize a convincing fake one that would be good enough to fool him. So he assumes all the ones he's seen are real. And as Sally points out, all men think that, and most women have done it. So that's probably not true.
Just even anecdotally, if all men have said, yeah, all the women I've been with, they've had proper real orgasms, and her,
and I can totally tell the difference.
Yeah, and her anecdotal evidence is, well, I know that all women have faked it at some point or another, and you just, yeah.
So our third example is actually the closest to the kind of canonical example, and this is from the 1949 film noir Shockproof, a film where a couple are on the run, and the fact that the woman has dyed her hair a couple of times by now is kind of a plot point. So when this gets brought up, it's relevant.
Oh, it's not hot water again. I'm just going to wash my hair and... Well, hair's dyed, isn't it?
Oh, yes, you see,
I can always tell dyed hair. I noticed the first day you got here. I bet you used to bleach it. Now it's dyed back to its natural colour, huh?
Yes.
Yeah, so, again, she says she can always tell.
Yeah.
If someone had very convincingly well-dyed hair, she just might assume...
Wouldn't.
It's not dyed hair.
Yes, exactly.
And therefore wouldn't have that extra evidence.
Yeah. And it's also, it's kind of... You go, oh, yeah, you have to get over the fact that she goes from, it's almost a non sequitur, you know, there's no hot water, I was going to wash my hair, your hair's dyed, isn't it?
Yeah.
Why would you say that? Why would you say that next? Unless it's, you know, an obvious plot point. Being in black and white is problematic.
Well, it's not very problematic because she went from blonde to dark brown, so, so it's fairly obvious.
See, in my mind's eye,
yeah,
she's dyed it red.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, the kind of slight non sequitur and the slight clunkiness of this is the kind of falling down of the film a little bit. This is a Douglas Sirk film, relatively early Douglas Sirk, written by Sam Fuller, and Fuller wrote a kind of more gritty, dark ending, and this is getting right up close to the ending. And that's why Douglas Sirk signed on to do the film, because he liked the Fuller script. And then the studio went, no, we need it to be a bit more upbeat. And it's a terrible ending. It's not a bad film. It's Cornel Wilde and Patricia White, who were married at the time and are good in it, but bad ending. It's like it all wraps up in a couple of minutes and it's like, oh, no, I want to see the original.
Yeah. It's the equivalent of Schubert's Unfinished, just ending.
So before we move on to fake news this week, I just want to talk about our Oscar pool, because our exclusive patron-only bonus episode that we're doing this week is a breakdown of the Oscars and what we think deserves to win, what we think will win, and all of that kind of stuff. So if you're a patron, you'll get to hear that. If you're not a patron, you can always become a patron. patreon.com/ftrump. But even if you're not a patron, and even if you're not going to listen to that, you can still sign up to our Oscars pool at fallacioustrump.com/Oscars, and you can choose what you think will win. It's just a bit of fun, really. It's just we thought it might be interesting for people to do, and I'd like to see what people think should win or will win.
Whether our influence holds sway.
Yeah, absolutely. So you can listen to us and then make your selections. That's fine. But the more people who sign up, the better. So what we're doing is we're actually going to donate $2 to the Ukraine Humanitarian Crisis Appeal that's being run by Care International for every one person that signs up.
So the more that sign up and do it, the more we'll donate.
Yeah, if you win, then we'll announce your name on the show and you'll get bragging rights. But if you don't win, at least you'll have helped us to raise a bit of money for Ukraine. If you would like to donate some money to Ukraine through Care International, I've made it a little bit easier for you. You can go to fallacioustrump.com/donate, and that will take you to your local Care International kind of hub where you can donate directly there. But obviously there's other options for donating, but that's just a quick and easy one for you. But if you want to do it and have fun, then fallacioustrump.com/Oscars.
So we're gonna play
fake news, folks. I love the game. It's a great game.
I understand the game as well as anybody.
Yes, it's time for fake news, the game where I read out three Trump quotes, two of which are real and one I made up, and Mark has to figure out which one is fake news.
Don't be fooled, listeners, because I can tell that I'm gonna win. You know, and how do I know? Well, I just know. I know I'm going to win about 60% of the time. And how do I know that? Because I've won about 60%
of the time. 49% of the time.
Yeah. But it's just, you know, but if you only look at if you only think about the amount of times I've won, then I've won a lot of the time.
This is true.
You know, long may it rain. That's, you know, that's it. I can just tell. I can tell this week is going to be a good week because it's been atrocious for the past couple. I've been outsmarted by listeners.
Yeah, you're on a route back, hopefully, to 50%.
Yeah.
If you get this one, you're on 50%.
I've been taking a rest from dumb luck. Yeah.
So these quotes are from Trump's rally in Florence, South Carolina last week.
Yeah.
And it was quite cold. So when it's cold, Trump doesn't like to be out there talking too long. So it was a reasonably short speech for him. Right. And he pretty much rattled through the stuff that was on the teleprompter. But he can't stop himself from just getting distracted the dog from Up.
Yeah.
And we'll go off on tangents.
Yeah.
So yeah, this is some of the stuff that he said, and some of it's quite weird. So statement number one.
Yeah.
The disastrous Green New Deal from AOC. I call them AOC plus three. We all need to worry because the ocean is going to rise 1/100 of an inch in the next 1,000 years. This insane woke agenda is killing our country, and we have to fight to the death if necessary to make sure nothing is more important. So we have to, oh look, it's my bikers. Bikers for Trump. We love our bikers. What a great group of patriots. They rev their Harleys, vroom vroom.
Squirrel. What? Okay. He's not sensitive to optics, is he? Talking about, you know, we like that these guys revving their petrochemical based machines whilst talking about climate change. Yeah, okay. Yep.
Statement number two. So sometimes I'll be making a speech and I'll go home and I'll check it out on television because I'll say, like, I wonder how it looks. And there'll be somebody.
Yeah, right. Every bloody time. Yeah.
And there'll be somebody in the audience behind us that's so stunning, that's so handsome or beautiful, that you cannot take your mind or your eyes off that person. And you know, sometimes Hollywood calls those people. So we've made a lot of really great stars sitting there.
What the hell? Wow. He's now claiming that he's providing casts for Hollywood. The guy is so conceited, isn't he? Jesus Christ. And also quite perverse as well. And you think, well, yeah, you don't think your handlers have stuffed all the good-looking people behind you? You know, not too good-looking, because it will make you look even more ugly than you are. Wow.
And statement number three.
All right.
This is his reaction to the Russian invasion of Ukraine. He says, it's a lack of respect for a lot of people, a lot of things, but it's just a total lack of respect. And it happens to be a man that is just driven. He's driven to put it together. And you look at it and it's just so ridiculous and so senseless and so horrible. And I say it again and I'll say it again and again. It should have never happened. If he respected our president, it would have never, ever happened. But no one ever mentions the bloody and horrific war raging just across our border.
Okay. Is that because there isn't one? Is that why they don't mention it? Yeah, yeah. It should. If he respected out, it would have never happened. But incidentally, no one mentions the blood. Okay. Right. Well, it's they're all just so insane that somebody must have written them. Okay. Oh my God. Right then, well, I think the 1/100 of an inch in the next 1,000 years is usual Trump hyperbole, but the squirrel bit for the bikers. Okay, I really want number two to be real. All right. No, but the bikers one's going to be real, isn't it? Bloody. Okay. All right. Could be going out on a limb. Could be controversial. I'm going to say that number three is the one that you made up.
Okay, and of the other two, which are you more convinced by?
The go home and check it out on television. It's going to be fake, isn't it? It's going to be fake.
Okay, and number two is real.
No.
So sometimes I'll be making a speech, and I'll go home and I'll check it out on television because I'll say, like, I wonder how it looks. And there'll be somebody in the audience behind us that's so stunning, that's so handsome or beautiful, that you cannot take your mind or your eyes off that person. And you know that sometimes Hollywood calls those people. So we've made a lot of really great stars sitting there.
Okay, so how... Right.
I mean, I have not been able to find an example of a not just a really great star, but anyone who has even slightly got any recognition by sitting at the back of Trump in a rally.
And you kind of think, okay, Trump, so you're on TV, you're looking at yourself on TV, and you're distracted by somebody behind you.
I so don't believe he's ever been distracted by... He's looking at himself. He doesn't know there's anyone else there.
Well, quite. That's my hence my point. Yes. So that... what the fuck? Very good. And he starts talking about himself. And you think, at the rallies, how many people are on the podium... sufficient for him to talk about in the plural. To use the royal we. Oh no.
So you also think number one is real?
Yeah.
And number one is fake news.
Oh man, I should have gone with my gut instinct. The whole it's a big all look bikers. Oh no. And the incident, the hundredth of an inch of a thousand years, you see, that's the hyperbole of Trump. That's big enough.
Yeah,
to be
he did actually. The shocking thing is, there are bits of this that are not very far away from the stuff he said. He said 100th of an inch in 3,000 years, 300 years rather, not 1,000 years. He did seem to get distracted by someone in his vision. Mm-hmm. And then start talking about Bikers for Trump at one point. But it was kind of, it wasn't quite. And he did make the noise of them revving their Harley. Yeah, he did do that. But it wasn't quite as egregious.
Wasn't as neat as that.
It was a bit of a kind of patch and add some stuff.
See, that's what I thought you'd done with the he's driven. Yeah. He's a driven man. He's driven it to put together. I thought, okay, but he's bits.
Is a real thing. That was how he described. I mean, I think he was just desperately trying not to say anything that was too anti-Putin. So
just in case.
It's a lack of respect for a lot of people, a lot of things, but it's just a total lack of respect. And it happens to be a man that is just driven. He's driven to put it together. And you look at it and it's just so ridiculous and so senseless and so horrible. And I say it again and I'll say it again and again. It should have never happened. If he respected our president, it would have never, ever happened. But no one ever mentions the bloody and horrific war raging just across our border.
Yeah. Again, I mean, leaving aside for the moment the non-existent bloody and horrific war.
Yeah.
Characterizing attacking a sovereign nation as a lack of respect
for a lot of things.
Personifying Ukraine as Rodney Dangerfield. It's just not.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the kindest you can possibly be to Putin, frankly.
Because he's a driven man. He's driven to put it together.
Yeah, he's driven.
And you look at it, and what he's doing is ridiculous and senseless and horrible. And if he'd have respected our president, well, he didn't respect you when you were president, Donnie. So why would it? What's it got to do with?
Yeah.
He's not going to be in fear of the US. He's fundamentally what he's saying. He's taking a sideswipe at Biden for not being fierce enough. And he, you know, if he'd have respected it, if we'd have commanded some respect from Putin, Not like Trump commanded any respect because he was, you know, all over him.
Yeah, there's this whole thing from the right and from Trump specifically saying, you know, oh, Putin didn't do it when I was president. Putin would, you know, wouldn't have dared. Whereas all it is Putin saw that Trump was doing his best to destroy NATO by himself.
Exactly, yeah.
And if he had got a second term, maybe he would have pulled out of NATO. So, yeah, he was just biding his time, just waiting for that. And no need to attack. And as for the bloody and horrific war raging just across the border, unclear.
Yeah. Which,
what,
Canada? Are they that mean up there? Really?
Unfortunately, that means that you have not yet made it back to 50%. You are now on 42 out of 86. So you're getting further and further away.
You're going to have to start listening to a gut again.
Yeah.
Mind you, I seem to recall that did me down last time. Yeah. It's not fair.
Hi, this is Dave.
And this is Brandon.
And we are FDR's Wheelchair,
a political podcast that aims to inform, educate, and joke.
Each week, we discuss the most current political events and hot topics from a progressive and humorous point of view.
Whether you're politically astute, curious, or if you're looking up the meaning of the word astute, we're the political podcast for you.
Listen to FDR's Wheelchair weekly, wherever you get your podcasts.
Yes, it's time for the part of the show that this week, at least, is called Needing a New Butt is Not a Logical Fallacy. Because...
Handmaid's Tale.
This is what happens when Republicans keep trying to get books banned and talking about how it's unacceptable to talk in school about particular things and you know, you've got to just regulate everything. I mean, part of, not even the bottom of the slippery slope, but part of the slope as it's sliding is what happened to a teacher in Mississippi who basically stepped in when a school administrator was supposed to be reading a book on Zoom to a bunch of 6 and 7-year-old pupils in Hinds County, Mississippi. The administrator couldn't do it at the last minute, so the assistant principal of an elementary school, Toby Price, stepped in and said, you know, I've got a book, I can read to them. And he read a book called I Need a New Butt, which is about a boy who notices that his butt has a crack in it and therefore he needs a new one. And this guy got fired for reading this book. And the letter that he was sent by the kind of the school board, the school district, is amazing because it describes what's in the book as if it should be offering evidence to why this is worthy of someone being fired.
Given that this is a book for 6-year-olds, isn't it? 4 to 6 or something like that. More proof that Republicans don't do humour.
Kids love stuff about butts and farts and stuff. So the letter includes the paragraph, on Tuesday, March 2nd, 2022, you read a book entitled I Need a New Butt to a group of students via Zoom. The story details a boy's journey to find a new butt after noticing his butt had a huge crack. During the reading of this book, you read inappropriate words like fart, as the story detailed how the boy had developed the huge crack when a fart had, quote, blew his butt apart and split it clean in two. You also shared inappropriate pictures that depicted the boy's naked butt. The book described butts in various colours, shapes, sizes and types. Example, fireproof, bulletproof, bombproof. This sounds like a fucking brilliant book.
It is. I've heard it read out,
All of the kids thought this was brilliant. People apparently came up to him and you know, contacted him and said it was great. They really enjoyed it. There were no complaints from parents about this stuff. This is the school board.
Tuned in or what?
Yeah, there's a school superintendent worried, panicking that they're going to get complaints. They're worried about parents complaining, and presumably because they've seen around the country idiots panicking about things in books that kids might learn from, or, you know, see that is in their view inappropriate, and you know, schools are in the media and being, and this is such a kind of now Streisand effect, because no one had heard of this school or this superintendent, or to a large extent this book, which is now like trending on Amazon, and they've definitely raised a significant amount of attention, and this is I mean, it's not the end result. There are much worse end results, but this is what happens when you panic too much about things your kids are reading.
Well, even in the, it is a kind of logical fallacy, because they are going from the point of view that all books are dangerous, or all schools will get into
there's
trouble
an assumption
for reading in a reading inappropriate material. And you think, well, they won't, and who's defines inappropriate? And it's a really good book. It's kind of done in a Dr. Seuss kind of rhyming way, and then the inappropriate pictures of a boy's naked butt, well, they're drawings of, you know, him deciding whether he'll get a multicolored butt or a robot butt. And it's just, it's hilarious. It reminds me of there was a book called Whose Poo Is This? So it's like this mole comes out of the ground and he's got a poo on his head, and he just goes around finding out what animals' poos look like. And kids love it. They love all that stuff.
Absolutely.
And they giggle at the audacity of it, you know, that there's in print is stuff that they talk about. Is it stuff that they're, and how can it be? Yeah, they're just going from the basis that, oh my God, we're going to get into trouble because this kind of stuff gets into trouble. And, well, where is the trouble? It's not from any of the parents. It's just peer pressure from, I don't know, where's it coming from?
It's not clear, really. Some people have suggested that maybe there was already some kind of animosity between the school superintendent and this teacher, and they were just kind of looking for an excuse to fire him. And I don't know. I mean, I don't know if Mississippi is an at-will state. It may be that they can just fire teachers if they fancy firing them. But I mean, that's certainly true in a lot of places. But I don't know. It sounds weird. It is weird.
Yeah.
And it's unclear what the thinking was. But, absolutely. This is, I mean, this guy who's been a teacher for 20 years, and he's been fired for reading a kid's book to some kids.
Yeah, by people who don't know.
Who loved it.
Who haven't been teachers for 20 years. You kind of, you know, that as a teacher of 20 years, knowing which age group you're going to talk to, knowing all of the material that is available, you would know if you're an experienced teacher working in primary education, you would know what will appeal to kids. So, and people are writing stuff for kids. You know, it's
absolutely
a kid's, but it's a published kid's book. Well, mind you, you know,
I mean, what kind of idiot doesn't realise that kids love slightly rude books? Like books that are, that have not at all rude words, but words that kids think are rude.
Yeah, and also that, and also it's about that kind of why have I got a crack in my butt kind of question. It's those unanswered questions, those unasked questions that it's that whole thing of adults who seem to, in, you know, these particular states that we talk about, who, when they become adults, seem to go back to the 1930s, 40s, 50s. They were, and they're adults you know, because they're in the States they are, they're adults in their 20s. They're parents in their 20s or their 30s. And they, so that means they were adults in the 90s, kids in the 90s. So they would have lived in the 90s. But, of course, living in those states in the 90s, their parents would have also travelled back to the 50s, the 1850s. So there's this kind of, what do they think is being taught to their kids after 30 years that they weren't taught? So there's this kind of weird transition back to suppressing everything. You know, it's kind of, it's the same thing happened in the UK with Margaret Thatcher's back to family values, which was, she was appalled at various theatre productions and books even that questioned the status quo, even of her government, and had them banned and closed down shows in theatres because she wanted to extol decent family values, go back to those kind of things, in order to appeal to, let's face it, an older voter base who believe that anything more modern than 1853 is a threat to decency and humanity. And we're in the 21st century, and you're firing somebody for reading a book for four to eight-year-olds about a kid who's worried about the crack in his butt.
Yeah. It is this book, by the way, only one in a series of books about butts. So there are others. And in the UK, I think it is published as I Need a New Bum, which makes sense. Yeah. It's just insane. When I can't remember if I told this story on the show or not, but when my kids were in primary school, elementary school, they at one point did a thing about the tiger who came to tea.
Oh, right, yeah.
And the teacher, I think it was my daughter, was about 5 or 6 at the time. The teacher sent home a thing in their school bags with the tiger who came to tea, kind of like the artwork on the front to say what they were doing.
Yep.
But she had not been very careful in her Google search.
Right.
And if you search for Google images of the tiger who came to tea, in amongst them are ones where people have kind of reimagined the story in what would literally happen if a tiger came to tea.
Yeah, yeah.
And Sophie ended up very bloody and, in bits.
Yeah. Yeah.
And unfortunately, that was the image that the teacher had kind of just absent-mindedly printed out and put on the front of this thing.
Fantastic.
Now, that we thought was hilarious.
Yeah.
But also obviously a mistake. And I don't, as far as I know, think that any other of the parents of our kids' class kind of caused an upset at the school about how awful this was.
Yeah.
It's not ideal. And if my daughter had seen it, maybe she might have been a bit upset about it because she did love that book. But
that's the difference, cultural difference between the UK and other parts of the world. Definitely the English speaking, we feel this. Well, that's because all the US is descended from the UK. we feel that we are closer to the US than we are closer to anywhere else, and yet completely divided culturally, separated by the same language, because the UK, we would just laugh that off. You just go, well, yeah, that's hilarious. That's really fun. But then we invented Monty Python. So that's kind of where that comes from, that kind of gallows humour. We get that. And that's national, it's a generational thing. There was a generation that were brought up on The Goons and their parents' generation didn't understand it at all, but they were brought up on Itmar and their parents didn't understand that. So it kind of, it goes on, and you know, it gets, and then, you know, generationally, the anarchic humour changes, but it's fundamentally the same. It's poking fun at authority, it's laughing in the face of adversity, and it's seeking out the ridiculous in situations, whether it's schadenfreude or not, but it's that kind of, we revel in the ridiculousness.
Whatever level you're at, it's finding that edge where it's where it's starting to become a bit dangerous, isn't it? That's the that's where a lot of comedy comes from, and a lot of
but it's funny, isn't it?
Absolutely.
There's a guy I follow occasionally on YouTube. He's a Canadian comedian. Can't remember, with ginger hair with glasses, and he posts stuff up from his stand-up things where he gets heckled.
Steve Hofstetter.
There you go. Well done.
Yeah.
And he bluntly says to the hecklers who take offence at what he's saying, he said, "This is comedy. You came out to a comedy night. You didn't know why you were coming. You bought tickets and everything." And then they kind of, and then they say, but what about Mexico, or what about blah blah blah? And he said, "Well, that's nothing to do with this gag. That's not how humour works." And you know, it's just he's excellent at dealing with heckles in that regard. But he does point that out, and he said, "This is just funny." And then he goes, "You're a Republican, aren't you?" And they go, "Yeah." He said, "Well, I could just tell." And he goes, he's like, "Yeah, you know, fair enough." But, and it's something to do with that, which, and I think that's why the Karen phenomena is a peculiarly American thing. It doesn't occur in the UK. People don't take umbrage. Well, they kind of do about parking spaces and things like that, but they don't take.
It really kind of puts into relief the whole snowflake thing, because it's again this divide between the right and the left, and a lack of understanding. And there's this belief apparently on the right that people on the left are just offended by everything, are just kind of, you know, looking for something to be offended by. They'll find offence wherever it might be found, whereas the things that upset the left or the left think should be changed or should be taken seriously are things that hurt people. things that cause a lack of representation or cause teasing or cause bullying or cause individuals to be downtrodden in some way or oppressed in some way
they're against the societal constructs that allow that legitimize that,
but something that in and of itself is a little bit offensive in general because it's a bit rude or it's a bit, you know, divisive in itself or whatever, that's fine. The left generally doesn't have a problem with that stuff.
No, but the right has a real problem with it.
They have a complete freak out about it.
They've just fired a man for reading a book for 4 to 6 year olds about somebody wondering why he's got a crack in his butt. Perhaps he broke it. That's what the actual fuck. You know, and yet the right say, "Oh well, the left complain about stuff." You know, it's the kind of. Well, actually, the similarity in the UK is from, people who say, "Oh, well, you can't say that anymore." You know, you used to be able to be horribly racist, you know, homophobic and misogynist. You used to be able to do that and offend the fuck out of people and really make them feel downtrodden and second class. And you could really, you know, lord it over them. We can't do that anymore.
Yeah.
It's terrible.
They get all offended.
You can't go doing that. You know, you used to be able to have people on the television making jokes about the colour of other people's skin. Can't do that anymore.
Yeah.
You know, or their gender.
Political correctness gone mad.
Yes. Can't do that anymore. And you think, and there's a direct correlation between where they are on the political spectrum and that viewpoint. Mm-hmm. That was, I was disturbed to find that I was sending various pieces of kind of artwork advertising my band's latest gigs to some sites that would share the demographics, so they would get the references to old-fashioned games and toys, or you know, bicycles, or that kind of stuff, which we write songs about and sing about as though we're still 12. You know, and it's that, all that kind of artwork. And I thought, oh yeah, I'll find some sites, some pages on Facebook, and share those, and you kind of put them on there. And then, of course, as soon as you join a group, you get their stuff in your feed, and it's full of all that kind of stuff. You go, oh yeah, remember when we used to be able to laugh at other people's misfortune? You know, remember when we used to treat people as second-class citizens, you know, in the name of comedy? Well, you can't do that anymore. And you go, oh my god. That's, and I think what the shock is that, you know, they're the similar age group to us in the band and me, and I'm thinking, but I didn't turn out like that. What happened to these? And it must just come down to, well, where are you on the political spectrum? Yeah. And finally, some things we really don't have time to talk about.
Republican misogynists, sorry, I'm repeating myself, Republicans all over America are so excited by the success thus far of Texas's anti-abortion law that they want one just like it in their state. You'll be shocked to hear that some of them are so giddy at the thought of controlling women's bodies they haven't put much thought into how, why, or pretty much anything else. Take, for example, Missouri State Representative Brian Seitz, who introduced a bill last week attempting to make it a Class A felony, punishable by between 10 and 30 years in prison, to perform an abortion to treat an ectopic pregnancy. For those who don't know, like, say, Republican lawmakers, an ectopic pregnancy is when a fertilised egg implants outside of the uterus. They can never result in the birth of a child, but they're super good at killing the mother. Ectopic pregnancies account for almost 2% of all pregnancies in North America and are the number one cause of death for pregnant mothers in the first trimester. When questioned about this, Seitz ignorantly claimed that doctors can't tell if a pregnancy is ectopic, saying, "They don't have the hospital machinery to tell if this is an ectopic pregnancy. They might just think it's a normal pregnancy and want to abort the child. I would like to see that sort of unlawful activity stopped." It's almost like people who know nothing whatsoever about basic healthcare or female anatomy and can't be bothered to look it up should stay the fuck out of trying to legislate it.
Yes, yep. If you're trying to do away with ectopic pregnancies, somebody somewhere must know what one is in order to be able to legislate against it.
I mean, Google exists.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Tucker Carlson's status as beyond Voldemort, insofar as it's actually illegal to take anything he says seriously, gets another nail in his credibility coffin this week. Though being a narcissistic fucking jerk, he won't look at it that way. When the Kremlin said his bulletins were important in the misinformation war they are blanket bombing their own people with. A leaked memo from the actual Kremlin to state media outlets, you know, the kind of outlets that Carlson thinks are lamestream sycophants in the US, says it is essential to use as much as possible fragments of broadcasts of the popular Fox News host Tucker Carlson, who sharply criticises the actions of the United States and NATO, their negative role in unleashing the conflict in Ukraine, and a defiantly provocative behaviour from the leadership of the Western countries and NATO towards the Russian Federation and towards President Putin personally. Advises the 12-page document written in Russian. It sums up Carlson's position. Russia is only protecting its interests and security. The memo includes a quote from Carlson. And how would the US behave if such a situation developed in neighbouring Mexico or Canada? In the Möbius strip that is Carlson's twisted moral compass, what point does he start ranting at himself for being the tool of Putin? Once he gets past gazing out of his arse at his own reflection, I guess.
One of my favourite kinds of porn over the past year has been watching insurrectionists get arrested because they filmed themselves insurrecting. Little did I realise that these fuckwits were mere amateurs in the art of self-incrimination. Even that bloke who filmed himself touching the Capitol while saying, "This is me touching the fucking White House," can't hold a candle to the epic, high-definition, Oscar-worthy self-incrimination of Roger Stone, Proud Boy Enrique Tarrio, and Oathkeeper Stewart, shot myself in the face because I'm a shitty firearms instructor, Rhodes. These three masters of the craft allowed a documentary film crew to follow them round while they coordinated the attempted overthrow of a democratically decided election. The film, A Storm Foretold, will be released later this year, but more than 20 hours of footage has already been provided by the documentary crew to the January 6th committee and to the Washington Post. Someone should really tell Roger Stone that the pardon he got from Trump was only good for crimes he'd committed up to that point.
Yeah, here's my get-out-of-jail-free card. You know that came from a Monopoly set, don't you? No, the president gave me it. Yeah. In one of those Zoom call think tank brainstorming sessions you imagine all critical thinking Republicans must be holding regularly to discuss tactics, strategist Amber Harris was urging the GOP in Michigan to give up trying to overturn the 2020 election during a Facebook live stream on Sunday. Robert Regan, poised to win a Michigan House seat, argued against Amber Harris by ostensibly attempting an analogy. Regan said, "I tell my daughters, well, if rape is inevitable, you should just lie back and enjoy it." Nice. 2 years prior, in June 2020, his daughter Stephanie's tweet went viral. "If you're in Michigan and 18 plus, for the love of God, do not vote for my dad for state representative. Tell everyone." Regan attempted to clarify his statement to the Grand Rapids Press on Monday, saying he was just trying to say you should never stop fighting, even when the outcome seems inevitable, and he wasn't trying to make a rape joke. Most people that feel like the election was stolen from them, well, that's similar to what they feel like. Regan blamed his daughter's stance on her socialist college education, but in her own follow-up tweet, Stephanie says that the real indoctrination had been at home. "This is what I was raised with," she wrote. "Took years to educate myself and feel proud to have different beliefs. It's still hard. Ask yourself if your beliefs are truly yours or if they were implemented by an authoritative figure." Regan doesn't make these misogynist comments despite being a father of daughters. He deliberately treats his daughters as tools to prop his comments up, which, of course, is the essence of misogyny itself.
He's very much not saying you should never stop fighting. He's literally saying stop fighting.
That, just stop fighting. just... And enjoy it.
Yeah.
It's
exactly the opposite of what he claims he meant by that.
Yep.
Fucking hell.
You know, as a father of daughters, as a breastfeeding mother of three, it's kind of, as a father of daughters, here is my sage advice.
Go, oh, boy.
What the actual... Yeah.
In possibly the least surprising turn of events since Tom Cruise divorced Katie Holmes, Trump did a crime. But more surprisingly, this time it might actually matter. Mere hours after we recorded our last episode, the January 6th committee made a federal court filing which indicated that they have good reason to believe Trump is guilty of engaging, quote, in a criminal conspiracy to defraud the United States. The filing was a response to Trump legal adviser John Eastman's attempt to assert attorney-client privilege over 90,000 documents that the committee would really like to look at. They give seven reasons that privilege doesn't apply, which include such airtight legal arguments as an unsigned letter of engagement doesn't prove you're Trump's lawyer, you sent all these emails from a college email server whose policy specifically says you have no expectation of privacy, your supposed client, Mr. Trump, has repeatedly waived privilege by talking to everyone, including Bob Woodward, about this stuff, and, most important of all, you can't claim privilege while you're helping your client commit fraud. If you need convincing that this is different to the 600 or 700 other crimes Trump committed, and let's face it, who could blame you, I strongly advise you to listen to episode 574 of the Opening Arguments podcast. And if you do, even you might believe that one day we'll see the Donald in a jumpsuit that matches his face.
Is it any wonder the Kremlin sent that memo about Tucker Carlson in an on-air display of utter smug fuckwittery? He lambasted Under-Secretary of State for Political Affairs Victoria Nuland for noting during Tuesday's Senate Foreign Relations Committee hearing that Russian propaganda groups are spreading information about how they have uncovered a plot by the Ukrainians to unleash biological weapons in the country. And thereby, Carlson completed the circle of disinformation. Unpaid Russian propagandist and QAnon legitimizer and rhymes with fucker drew conclusions for no one's benefit. So what you're saying, Victoria Nuland, if, for example, you were funding secret biolabs in Ukraine but wanted to hide that fact from the people who were paying for it, in whose name you were doing it, then you might lie about it by claiming the Russians were lying about it. In other words, you might mount a disinformation campaign by claiming the other guy was mounting a disinformation campaign. Is that what you're saying, Victoria Nuland? Sensible centrist Steve Bannon got a bit fired up, asking the CIA and Defense Department, what are they creating? Are they involved in any way? Have we financed it? Are we partners? Do we actually know what's going on? No, Steve, you don't. And equally level-headed, calm thinker Mike Flynn wrote over Telegram, I was told that biolabs in Ukraine was a conspiracy theory, yet here we are. They are now admitting it openly. No, no, they're not. It's just Tucker the fucker. Listen, Comrade Carlson, come the revolution, A, it won't be televised so no one will be able to see you, and B, Putin's not going to roll a red carpet out for you to thank you for all the work you've done for him. We in England still have a traitor's gate through which the likes of you were taken to the Tower of old. No TV reception in there either.
Dishonest Republicans, sorry, I'm repeating myself again, Republicans have been trying to convince us all that election tampering is a real issue for a while now, and the length some of them will go to is kind of impressive. Like in the case of Mesa, Colorado County Clerk Tina Peters, tampering with elections herself. So committed was Peters that in the process of proving just how easy it is to subvert an election, she committed 7 felonies and 3 misdemeanors, according to the grand jury who indicted her this month. Essentially, Peters and her deputy, who's also charged with various crimes, arranged for security cameras to be turned off during the software update of the Dominion voting machines, stole the identity of an IT contractor, made a copy of the voting machine's hard drive, and published images that included confidential passwords for the county's election equipment on right-wing websites. Weirdly, she still hasn't dropped out of the race she's currently in to become Secretary of State. You know, the person who's in charge of running elections in Colorado. Sure, it's bad, but imagine how much worse it would be if these people were actually any good at criming.
In British politics this week, equipped with the new post-Brexit ability to do adult things they thought they couldn't do when part of the EU, the UK government simply reverted to childishly saying no, 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 no to Europe because we did things faster and bigger than you. Dime store pantomime Uriah Heep, Jacob Rees-Mogg, proudly showed off a chart illustrating just how many more oligarch assets they had frozen than the combined EU and all the US, only to have it pointed out by, well, I don't know, everyone, that simply showed that this UK government had been laundering billions more dirty Russian money than anyone else. Michael Gove, Slimy Tove, gyred, gimbaled and postured in Parliament demanding that oligarchs' empty London mansions should be seized and used to house Ukrainian refugees. Professional squatters took him at his word and got into Oleg Deripaska's 200-bedroom city block of a building in London's Belgravia and erected a banner over the balcony quoting Gove. Police, of course, arrived in minutes and arrests were made because Gove obviously didn't mean straight away. You've got to give them some chance to sell up and move their assets out of the country. Be fair. Meanwhile, out of the country, Boris visited Saudi Arabia to find an alternative to Russian fuel and whilst at the same time declaring Putin guilty of crimes against humanity, ignored the small matter of 81 beheadings happening in Saudi Arabia mere days before he arrived. Lesser of two evils. Better the devil you know? Or who's got money that we can suck up now to fund the party? Whatever happened to COP26's net zero renewables? Well, we didn't mean straight away, obviously. Well, yes. Thank you, Gove.
So that's all the bad arguments and faulty reasoning we have time for this week. You'll find the show notes at fallacioustrump.com. And if you hear Trump say something stupid and want to ask if it's a fallacy, our contact details are on the contact page.
If you think we've used a fallacy ourselves, let us know. And if you've had a good time, please give us a review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Or simply tell one other person in person about how much they'd like our podcast. And you can support the show at patreon.com/ftrump. just like our straw man level patrons Steve Bickle, Schmutz, Mark Reike and Amber R. Buchanan, and our true Scotsman level patrons Kaz Tui, Andrew Houck, Max Beaver and our top patron Lauren. Thanks very much everyone for your continued support. It really is appreciated.
You can connect with those awesome people as well as us and other listeners in the Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/FallaciousTrump.
All music is by The Outbursts and was used with permission. So until next time on Fallacious Trump, we'll leave the last word to the Donald.
That's right. Go home to mommy. Bye. Bye.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.